Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. And this is a special Friday edition. I'm Barbara Bernstein and your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. 1 year ago, the small town of Mosier in the Columbia River Gorge made regional and national news as firefighters battled for 14 hours to contain a dangerous oil fire from a derailed 96-car Union Pacific train carrying highly flammable Bakken crude oil. 1 year later, Mosier's groundwater is still contaminated, and oil and railroad companies are seeking to expand oil and coal train traffic through the Columbia River Gorge, despite opposition from Columbia River tribes, the town of Mosier, and many larger cities along the potential route. On this special Friday edition of Locus Focus, we observe the one-year anniversary of the near disaster in Mosier. We're joined by Columbia River Keepers Conservation Director Dan Sears and by phone Mosier Mayor Arlene Burns. Dan and Arlene, welcome back to Locus Focus.
It's great to be here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And Arlene, you are in North Carolina, is that correct?
That's right.
Just like you were last year at this time.
Exactly, yes.
So I want to just go back a year, be actually a year ago tomorrow, and just, I want to start with Dan, because I remember talking to you, Dan, right after you got this news. Where were you when the train caught fire?
In a very ironic twist, I was sitting in a meeting in Vancouver, Washington, about what the response would be if an oil train were to derail and spill into the Columbia River. I made eye contact with a first responder who was there in the room, and we were getting the same message, which was an oil train had derailed and spilled and was on fire. At that point, we didn't know whether it had reached the Columbia River. The oil ended up reaching the Columbia River, unfortunately, and forming a sheen at the mouth of Rock Creek. It was a really jarring day. Quickly got a call from our executive director, Brett Vandenhoevel, and our communications director, Liz Tahar, who raced up there having gotten the word from a tribal fisherman that there was an oil train on fire in Mosier, and they were really shocked at what they saw when they drove over the overpass off exit 69 right off Highway 84, and the oil train was burning there. And so we heard from friends in Mosier that they were being evacuated from the school. We heard from many others that first responders were moving towards the region very quickly. It was a terrifying day. We didn't know how long the fire would burn. It ended up burning for 14 hours. And for people throughout the region, this was a wake-up call we didn't need. You know, the fact that I was sitting in a meeting about oil trains derailing and catching fire was a pretty good indication. We were aware of this risk before it happened. And the fact that it happened so spectacularly right in our own midst was a very jarring event.
Well, actually, you were, one of the people in that meeting was Jared Larrabee, who's
right.
with Vancouver Energy, which is the company, which is actually to Cyril Savage, which wants to build the largest oil by train terminal in North America in Vancouver, Washington. I have been interviewing him either the day before or 2 days earlier and asked him specifically about the danger of oil train derailments. And he was saying, well, we are doing everything that's state of the art and we don't expect that to happen. I emailed him right after the oil train exploded, and he actually forwarded my email to somebody, I think, from Tesoro, because he's with Savage Company. And basically, they said that it's Union Pacific's problem.
Right. And that's what we hear, you know, from the oil terminal operators. And then we hear from Union Pacific that, you know, they're a common carrier required to carry oil trains for companies like Tesoro Savage or U.S. Oil, who is the company in Tacoma that was supposed to receive that train that derailed in Mosier. And so where that leaves us now, and looking at this year in the interim, we've seen people like Arlene and people from all over the region become very vocal, become leaders about stopping the oil terminals themselves, which generate this oil train traffic, because we know that no level of oil train traffic is safe.
Well, Arlene, I want to get to you now. You're basically in the same place a year ago that you are now. Is that correct, when you heard the news about the oil train derailing in your town?
Yes, that is correct. Each year, actually since 1986, I speak to the graduating senior class of a school and they fly me here. So that's why I'm here again, alas, missing the anniversary in Mosier. But climate change has been the topic of the last couple of years of my talk, put it that way.
So I wanted to know, what was it like? You basically, as I recall you telling me that you received a text message while you were driving a year ago?
Yes, and it was within 2 minutes. A friend of mine who is actually house-sitting, who's a filmmaker, was just driving into Mosier, and within a minute of the train crashing. So he texted me, and then I called him back, and he kept just saying it's not looking good, and it was very, very ominous. And he asked what from my house he should get out, and the first thing were my cats, of course. But we've gone through this little practice in 2009 when a 600-acre fire had come to the very edge of Mosier, and the town was mostly evacuated then. So it's a strange thing. It's like having a baby far away, and I felt helpless in many ways. And the one thing I could do was be a media point as long as I was informed, and I was being filled in all the time with the phone ringing nonstop. So, yeah, it was pretty hard to be a long way away.
But it sounded like I could hear you from 3,000 miles away on the radio, both here on cable and OPB. So it sounded like you were being pretty much kept up to date or up to the moment with what was going on. And what role did you feel you were playing being back in North Carolina, and what roles were being played on the ground in Mosier?
Well, actually, ironically, because I was not on the ground, I had the time and place to field calls, which once I got back to Mosier, it was almost impossible to answer the phone. My voicemail had filled up, and I was in perpetual meetings with the incident command, with people in the town, with the firefighters, with the cleanup efforts. So it was sort of a blessing in a sense to be far enough away that I could really dedicate my time to fielding calls.
Well, I remember a week after the incident, I came out to interview you in Mosier, and the city sort of had been turned, it felt like a construction site or worse. And I remember we had to keep the doors closed to your house because you could hear all the machinery down at the tracks as they were, I guess, pounding all those rivets back in. What was it like to be living in the city, in the town, after in the aftermath of the fire? And do you feel like you've ever come back to normal, basically, from that event?
Well, certainly we had more people arrive in town to deal with the incident than we did as the population of the town itself. And so it felt incredibly industrial. And we were very thankful for all the effort and the help and the, five-star, incredibly talented teams and coming from all over the country, really. And it was essential to get the mess cleaned up as much as possible. While cars were still along the side of the tracks, Union Pacific did make a decision that they were going to resume train traffic, and we did hold an emergency city council meeting and asked them to please wait until things were cleared up. And they did not honor that, but they said that they had deemed things to be safe, and indeed we didn't have an incident again. But ever since then, our town has been a little bit fried. I mean, I think all of us woke up to what was at our doorstep all along, and even more than what's there now is what potentially could be there if these terminals are allowed. And so in some funny way, it's really a blessing in disguise, because I think that the track expansion would have probably gone through unnoticed, and the Tesoro Savage Terminal might have been permitted without us kind of knowing what was afoot. And it's interesting, too, because as Dan said, Union Pacific does not have a choice of not carrying this oil, so it's really imperative that these terminals are stopped, and also that we try to keep it in the ground from the other end until the laws change that say this is not legal to take these on the tracks. So I've learned a lot about fossil fuels. I've learned a lot about railroads, and we've been working for the last year with Union Pacific negotiating a settlement out of court in a very unique way for them, I think, with the community trying to tell our story in a very soulful way. And so far, it's been an incredibly respectful process. And though it's not over yet, we expect to conclude this process within the coming weeks. And we really hope that, at least with regard to the derailment itself, first of all, Union Pacific has definitely been cleaning up everything they could. They rebuilt our sewage treatment plant, our wastewater treatment plant, and they have been with DEQ of funding the cleanup of the contamination in the groundwater, which is not affecting our drinking water. It's sort of migrated towards the wetlands, but it's a serious concern, and it is getting better. But from the latest report from DEQ, there still is contamination in our groundwater. So it's been quite a process. And now when these trains go by, and, you know, we have 4 a month now, you just get this chill that runs up your spine, because there are a few things we know that we didn't before. The cars that this oil is in, they are not really capable of withstanding a crash of any more than 30 miles an hour. And the new cars that are proposed aren't required to be online for several more years. And even those cars cannot withstand an impact at full speed. So there's not a solution that looks great whatsoever, except keep it in the ground and stop the terminals.
Now, you said to me last year that this gave you an opportunity. So there's a reason why Mosier was chosen, as you said, for this horrible event, because it was going to make you a microphone for this cause. And how has that manifested?
Well, I think that, I mean, I don't know if there's some kind of cosmic clarity in all of this or not, but certainly Mosier has become a fulcrum in a much larger conversation about fossil fuel infrastructure development and fossil fuel export, which we're really facing since Obama lifted the ban on crude oil export and these terminals being proposed everywhere. And then this larger and very pertinent conversation of climate change and carbon loading that I just returned actually 3 days ago from Telluride, the Mountain Film Festival, which I used to direct, and the whole subject of the festival was climate change, and top scientists and people from the Obama administration, the White House, were all discussing the scientific reality of the carbon loading, and we really must get ourselves off of fossil fuels. And so all of this, the infrastructure development, and even not just shifting all our efforts at this point to this paradigm shift towards renewable energy is insane for those of us who understand the science. So I really hope that the gift that can come out of our moments of despair is that we can be this tipping point, this fulcrum towards a different way of being in the world that is sustainable for future generations, because our planet, the life on Earth is at risk, and it's a very serious matter. And the idea that our current administration is in this place of denying the science is incredibly frustrating to the scientists. They're like, well, truth is truth. You know, this isn't a matter of believing or not believing. Just because you don't believe doesn't mean that the reality isn't there. And the acidification in the ocean, you know, there are all sorts of effects. And we're just one little piece in this. But I really believe that the Northwest and California are poised. We're in the position to lead the way for the rest of the country the world in a different way of being on the planet.
Actually, I want to have you repeat that. You just cut out for a second. So what you're saying about the Northwest and California is in the position to lead the way? And what else were you saying?
It's crucial. The time is here. We're not going to get the support from the federal government, obviously, with regard to really addressing climate change. So we need to be smart and bold and innovative. The technology is there. The investment has already shifted away from fossil fuel infrastructure development into renewable energy development. The economic reality is there with regard to this technology. And somebody needs to put it in place. And I really believe that the temperament of Oregon, California, and Washington can be this shift and can lead the way. And I think all of us are emboldened to stand up for what we realize is essential, and to be smart about it, and to not wait for our federal government to do this for us.
Well, if you're just tuning in this morning, you're listening to a special edition of Locus Focus. This is the rare Friday edition, and we're observing the one-year anniversary of the near disaster in Mosier when an oil train derailed and almost set the town on fire. And it was just because the wind wasn't blowing that day that Mosier is still around. And my guests this morning are Arlene Burns, who we just heard from, who's the mayor of Mosier, and Dan Sears, who's in the studio with me, who is Columbia River Keepers Conservation Director. Dan, we talked last year about the impact. Well, as the ball was rolling to get this very, very humongous oil-by-rail terminal built in Vancouver, as the Port of Vancouver was just about to come to a vote about granting a permit to Tesoro Savage to build this project, there was the most famous and maybe the most disastrous oil train explosion in Lac-Mégantic in Quebec. What impact did that have on the plans that Tesoro Savage had to build this terminal and the response from the community? I remember talking to the Port of Vancouver spokesperson who was saying, we had no idea there was such a danger before Lac-Mégantic, that there was a problem with transporting oil. However, you might beg to differ about that.
Well, people have been raising the issue of what could happen, but there's no question that Lac-Mégantic opened everyone's eyes. Just a couple weeks before, Tesoro Savage representatives had been in front of the port telling the port that crude oil from the Bakken Formation was like mother's milk. That was the exact word, the term they used, mother's milk, to describe how sweet and light and relatively harmless it would be. Obviously, you know, what happened in Lac-Mégantic, the tragedy that killed 47 people, very quickly punctured that fallacy. And despite that, the Port of Vancouver moved ahead, really arguing or feeling that, you know, that derailment was a one-off event, that it was unlikely to be replicated in other places. And they voted to proceed with the oil terminal. In the ensuing, we're now 4 years into this, we have seen over a dozen, probably approaching 20 now, major oil train derailments. Thankfully, none of these additional derailments have cost lives directly. But they very well could if we allow this oil train traffic to continue. And that's why the Tesoro Savage decision is so incredibly important. It seems just blaringly obvious that Governor Inslee should turn this project down. And, you know, we're trying to use every method we can of getting the word out in the region because people from Spokane and Hermiston and Tacoma and all over the region are really invested in seeing these oil trains stop. And we're looking at now really the last of these major oil train proposals. Tesoro Savage is one of the last ones that's really actively pushing forward. Grace Harbor has been able to put their facilities on hold thanks to the incredible activism from people there and the leadership of the Kanawha Nation, the Kanawha Indian Nation. The same is true for people up in Anacortes who stopped an oil by rail facility there. And so we're down to the Vancouver Energy, as they call themselves. We call them Tesoro Savage because that's the name of the companies involved. You know, this is it. At 360,000 barrels of oil a day, you know, Arlene talked about, you know, Mosier sees four trains a month. Tesoro Savage would be five trains a day, potentially, coming down the Columbia River Gorge.
It's on both sides. So Mosier might only get half of them, right?
Yeah, or Mosier might only get one a day. But still, that's a massive increase over what we see right now. And it's just a risk that is so enormously unnecessary for the region. And we think we're winning that argument. We really are looking for the Energy Council in Washington to make a recommendation to Governor Inslee that he deny this project, and then Governor Inslee just go ahead and turn this thing down. It's dragged on for far too long, and we are eager to see the decision come.
Well, I'm wondering what's taking him so long. Now, Governor Inslee joined with Jerry Brown in California and Andrew Cuomo in New York and basically creating an alliance of states that are going to sign on to the Paris Climate Accords without the United States government, without the federal government. And so if he can understand the importance of reducing emissions and really looking in the face at all the dangers and threats of climate change, why can't he do the simple thing of just vetoing this terminal?
It hasn't come to his desk yet, and that's the real reason. The Energy Council is taking a long time to get through a very large, you know, it's really an unprecedented project. We're talking about something that would be half the size of the Keystone XL pipeline almost in only oil trains, which is just hard to imagine building a project of that size. And so For good reason, it's taken them a long time, also because Tesoro Savage has provided inaccurate and incomplete information, which has dragged the process out for many years. We're now in a position where we think FSEC will make a recommendation in the coming months. And so, you know, for instance, this Saturday, tomorrow, we'll all be in Mosier and trying to send a message to both FSEC and Governor Inslee that there's no clearer argument for denying that project than what happened in Mosier 1 year ago.
And I wonder how much the Mosier near catastrophe has played into, as Arlene was suggesting, maybe slowing down the momentum for the Tesoro Savage terminal to go ahead.
You know, Mayor Burns and other folks from Mosier who became spokespeople on this issue deserve an enormous amount of credit. They could have quietly sat by and let this disaster happen and, you know, lick their wounds after. Instead, you know, they came to Portland and they testified in Portland. They came to Vancouver. They testified in Vancouver. Both of those cities have now banned oil terminals from coming in. This decision now with Tesoro Savage is being made at a higher level. It's the governor of Washington. And so I think there is real momentum that's built in this last year, thanks to the fact that, you know, people from the Columbia River Gorge have stepped up and they've used their suffering and the sacrifice that all those folks made to actually make a real change in this debate.
Well, Arlene, I wanted to get back to something you mentioned sort of at the beginning of the program about the track expansion that was being proposed for the Union Pacific tracks that run through Mosier. What was being proposed and how did you stop that?
Well, we haven't stopped it yet, but as irony would have it, at the very place where the train derailed, Union Pacific is trying to do what would end up being a 5 mile long active double track, meaning trains could pass each other in opposite directions at full speed. And this is because we are known to the railroad as the bottleneck of the Northwest, Mosier is. It was also when they built the freeway and the railroad in the first place where there was tremendous effort because of the geology of the area and the cliffs and the depth of the river there. So this probably would have gone through without us realizing what we were really signing on for. Mosier itself doesn't have much power. And as we've realized in this, you know, this process for the permits was not really Mosier's choice, but it was a Wasco County permit that the original at the county planners accepted, the county commissioners took a bold statement and denied the permit on the basis of treaty rights. And this then was going to be bumped up in appeal to the Gorge Commission, who were the active body of the National Scenic Area, which made it on a federal level, which was really important because the railroad is directed by the FRA. And as that was just happening, Union Pacific actually sued the Gorge Commission and the county commissioners, so Wasco County, saying we don't need to ask your permission because we're the railroad. And then that was bumped up, and now it's in the Ninth Circuit Court. Union Pacific did ask for a quick decision and was denied that decision. So this is an ongoing thing, and we really are fighting for our lives on this one. And it's really, really just so important that if this infrastructure will enable more of these unit trains of oil, that this is one other little way. This is another piece in the puzzle to stop this expansion. But if the Ninth Circuit Court denies it, then we'll go back at that point to the Gorge Commission and there'll be a hearing there. So I don't know how long all these court processes take. But again, we are not only representing Mosier, we're representing every single community along the tracks. And that's what we've realized. You know, I happen to be the mayor of the town where it happened, but it could have happened anywhere from North Dakota to Tacoma and with much, much worse results had it gone into the Columbia River, for example. So yeah, I feel like we were sort of given the megaphone and understand it's complex issues, but this whole oil export it's sort of the last breath of what has to be a dying energy in a dying industry. And a very few people will make a whole lot of money with putting in the meantime all the communities along the tracks at risk. So it's just a very short-sighted, misguided thing. And even the cost of the development, doesn't make sense on a long-term scale.
Well, how do you feel about the statement that Trump made yesterday, pulling out of the Paris Climate Accords? And what do you feel like our response can, I mean, how does that make, what kinds of threats does that make you feel? And what do you think can be a response on a local and regional level that might counter and maybe even undermine what Trump was trying to do? And I have both of you talk. So Arlene, why don't you give me your response first, then we'll have Dan.
Okay, well, first of all, I guess none of us are surprised. I was with Al Gore with his Climate Reality Project in early March, and we talked a lot about what happens and what if. And the interesting caveat about this is that on many levels that have nothing to do with climate change, it was really a misguided move on Trump's part, because by default, by us backing out of it, it puts China as the world leader strategically in this endeavor. So we are basically losing our position in the world, and the currency could follow that. So a lot of the folks there actually thought, not because of climate change, but because of this strategy that the Trump administration might stay in. And but, you know, I think exactly what we need to do is what's happening is all of us are realizing on a local level, on a regional level, on a state level, that it's up to us to take the power and make the commitment of the Paris Agreement in all ways we can, and join to where we are a strong force of a change towards good. And I still have a heck of a lot of hope that we really can put this new way of doing things into motion in the Pacific Northwest, especially. Oregon has a temperament for leading the way on things. And so hopefully we all feel more activated and emboldened to step up and put extra skin in the game and do all we can. And just like with the tribes, you know, they weren't necessarily so unified, but they are completely unified on this issue. And so there's a lot of power when you get people together and you become aligned. And, you know, it's been interesting being in the Southeast, because it is not the same temperament down here as in the Pacific Northwest. So I think we do have a responsibility to lead the way in all ways we can.
Actually, I'm kind of curious, since you're in North Carolina, which is one of these states that seems like it's pivoting, it kind of wobbles back and forth between really becoming progressive and really remaining regressive. And what is your sense, particularly being there yesterday when Trump made his statement, do you feel that there's a stronger sense even in North Carolina that we need to have strong requirements for reducing our carbon footprint?
Well, among my friends, yes. But there are oases here, like Asheville, North Carolina, which is where I am at the very moment. And it in North Carolina is a bit of an anomaly. And the odd thing about all of this is you would think that the educated people, the people who understand that science is science, would utterly be on board. But there's a funny temperament in the South. And I was speaking to my friends last night about this, and they're all hoping that the Northwest can help save the country. And I said, well, what about you guys doing this here? You know, you need to propose these things. And they just laughed at me and said, it will never happen here. And it might be just that people, you know, have their heels dug in and they're affected by the news they get, and their sources of news might not be very realistic or accurate. And so, yeah, I think it's up to us. I think it's on our plate.
Yes, it's, I guess Earl Blumenauer sent me an email yesterday talking about the green wall that we're building. And I guess when the Portland infrastructure, fossil fuel infrastructure ban was passed last winter, Charlie Hales referred to it as putting another stone in the green wall, which sounds a little stronger than the thin green line that we've been talking about. Maybe it's turning into a wall. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to a special Friday edition of Locus Focus, and we're talking about the first anniversary of the Mosier oil train derailment last year. And we're joined by the mayor of Mosier, Arlene Burns, who you just heard from, and Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper. Dan, what is your take on the impact that Trump's pronouncement it sort of felt like it was another episode of the Celebrity Apprentice, actually, the way he spun it out. But what's your take on his pronouncement and maybe how it's mobilizing people more than ever?
Yeah, on two fronts, I think people in the Northwest are exceptionally mobilized right now on issues of climate. The first is, as we saw yesterday, the city of Portland and Multnomah County, thanks to great work on behalf of 350 PDX and Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility and so many other groups, they really led the way and persuaded the city council of Multnomah County to set a goal of being 100% renewable by 2050 and having all electricity generated from renewable sources by 2035. And so we see, and that's really an outgrowth of momentum from statements to oppose new fossil fuel infrastructure in both Portland and Vancouver. And so we see this building where cities are realizing and counties are realizing that we have a role and we have work to do here that is not touched necessarily by bad decisions at the federal level. And then the other really critical front is we have really huge fossil fuel projects proposed right in our midst that we're still fighting like crazy to get turned down. The biggest of those right near us is obviously the DeSoto Savage project in Vancouver. And so people are taking action. You know, the brick wall, the green brick wall is made up of a lot of individual actions and hearings and rallies and things we can do to build momentum to make that thicker and thicker and stronger and stronger. Two of those things that are coming up, you know, tomorrow, everyone will be getting together in Mosier at 12 noon at the Mosier Community School. We expect to have a big crowd, and we're going to listen to Joe DeGaudi. He's the chairman of the Yakima Nation Tribal Council, who will be one of the featured speakers to talk about how Governor Inslee needs to turn down that big oil terminal in Vancouver. And then if folks are really fired up, they get to go to an air permit pollution hearing, or an air pollution permit hearing for the DeSoto Savage project, which would be a major emitter of toxic and smog-forming volatile organic compounds in Vancouver. People in Vancouver have been doing a ton of research and have really exposed how there's a toxic icing on this very poisonous cake of the DeSoto Savage project, which is, even if the trains don't blow up, they have an enormous negative impact on the people who live nearby. And so on both of these fronts, both trying to make real concrete progress towards establishing renewable energy in the Northwest, and also stopping these really terrible, terrible ideas like the DeSoto Savage project or the methanol refinery up in Kalama. These are all things that people are doing incredible work to make an impact on right now.
Actually, I want to throw out one more. It's PGE's plans to build two natural gas-fired power plants in Boardman, which I know there was a hearing that the Public Utility Commission had a couple weeks ago, and I don't know where that's all going, but that's another issue people should be really watching and being involved in.
Yeah, and I think that's a good example of how citizen, you know, activism has had a huge impact. PGE was barreling towards building two more fracked gas-fired power plants at Boardman, and thanks to enormous opposition and an outpouring of concern from people throughout the region, including here in Portland, people who would be receiving that energy, PGE is putting on pause, at least, its plans to build those plants, which is anytime you can change the direction of a huge utility like PGE, it shows you're having an impact. And that's what we need to do with this oil terminal. We need to ensure that the council hears from that same level of concern. They hear that concern and they act on it. You know, it's at this point, it's common sense. What happened in Mosier told us all, as clearly as anything could, that oil trains are reckless. That's the basis on which the council should simply deny the largest oil train terminal proposed in North America.
So where is this rally again to be? Because people probably don't know where the Mosier Community School is.
Yeah, the Mosier Community School, it's right off the exit there in Mosier. It's hard to miss. It's at 1204.
Exit 69, right?
Yeah, exit 69. And it's at 1204 Old Highway 30 in Mosier. We're going to be gathering there, hearing from speakers tomorrow to mark this one-year anniversary. We'll pause and have a moment of silence at 12:15, which is when the train derailed. And then we're going to walk down to the river. It's about a 0.4-mile walk, and hear from a couple other folks who will speak at the river. We'll talk about, you know, the impact on Mosier, and we'll talk about the importance of Governor Inslee turning down the largest oil train terminal in North America. And then the following that, a few days later, there'll be a major public hearing in Vancouver. There's more information about that up on our website at columbiariverkeeper.org.
And it's at Clark College?
It's at Clark College, which is 1933 Fort Vancouver Way. And that hearing starts at 1, pauses at 4, and begins again at 5. And in that pause, we'll have a rally with speakers there as well. And so we're hoping to have a big crowd there to make really the final closing argument to the Energy Facility Siting Evaluation Council for Washington about why they should deny this terminal, starting with the air pollution, but really touching on the fact that they're holding a hearing about 1 year after this major oil train derailment.
It's just interesting. And we'll have links to your website on the Locust Focus website as well, so people can find out. And I do believe when you go up, you cross over the interstate bridge, you take your first right and go towards Fort Vancouver, and then the signs that take you. It's very well marked to get to the college.
It is, yeah. It's easy to find.
And how is parking there?
Parking can be a little bit challenging, but if you leave yourself a little extra time, it should be okay, as I think school is beginning to wind down. Depending on when people are arriving, we're really encouraging everyone to come. If they come during the afternoon, to stay until 4 p.m. when we're going to have a rally and have speakers outside. And if you're coming for the evening part, to come a little bit early and arrive by 4 p.m. so that we can have a critical mass there and hear from some of the people who've been really digging in and doing research, including a Vancouver engineer who's been, you know, really exposing how the volatile organic compounds from this project would have a big impact, not just on the neighborhoods that are right nearby, but even on downtown Vancouver. And these are, you know, opinions that are corroborated by expert reviews. And so, again, it's, you know, you had me at exploding oil trains. That's enough of a reason to turn down the oil terminal, but it turns out that the toxic air pollution is another major reason.
So, Arlene, when you return...
What about the upcoming earthquake?
Yeah.
You know, this is another major reason in the liquefaction zone, and it's going to be, I mean, that again is not some sort of conspiracy theory. It's something that we all need to be preparing for. And our event in Mosier, which was an incredibly minor event compared to a 9 earthquake that the Pacific Northwest is expecting, but it gave us a glimpse of what gridlock traffic does and how it was so hard for people to move, to get out or to get in, or to get for the people from PDX with the foam truck to even access where they needed to come. And when you think of putting a major oil terminal in an area where we're poised to be dealing with some hugely critical geologic event, that's also incredible insanity on my part.
So, Arlene, in the coming weeks and months when you return to Mosher, what do you see as your plan of action to continue this fight, to stop the fossil fuel infrastructure, but also to move towards a fossil-free future?
Well, one of the groups that I am super excited about being involved with is called SELA, the Safe Energy Leadership Alliance. And it was started by Dow Constantine, who's the executive of King County, which is the fourth largest county population-wise in the United States. And at this point, we have 160 elected officials from communities along the tracks, and we have tribal chairmen all involved. And the great thing about this group is we're already representing our constituencies, and we can send poignant, articulate messaging at very specific times to specific places and projects that are, again, it's quite a unified front when you start having this mass of people representing each of our communities. So, in fact, the day after I get back, we have a city council meeting, and I'm going up to Seattle to meet with Dow Constantine and his group, and we will strategize on how to be the most effective. I'm actually also going to Aspen in late June or June 19th for it's called the R-Day Summit. It's not named after me, but it's about renewable energy, and it's been going on for several years. So I really want to try to, again, not only focus on the problem, but focus on the solution. And I think they have to go hand in hand. It's one thing to say we don't want this, but, you know, I'm going to be flying on a plane to get back there. I'm driving my car. So we have to replace what's wrong with what's right. And I'm dedicating my life force to it. I feel that I was plopped into this position as mayor at this time, in a sense, and given the tools to work on a multitude of levels and a multitude of facets and all of them are crucial. And we need to stay awake and alert and alive and use our minds and use our energy. And so, ironically, I still feel hopeful that we have this capability and this possibility of really making a difference in our region and thus in the world.
Well, I see Moshe as a leader in this region. And you said that it's a little town that...
Small enough to make a difference.
Right, okay.
That's our motto.
Right.
Yeah. The little town that could.
Right. So, I'm not sure. It seems like you contradict a lot of people's stereotypes of a small town mayor. But I'm wondering if there's more small town mayors like you than people realize.
Oh, I think there are. I think there are sleepers out there all the time. And, you know, it's interesting. We are light on our feet because we're small, but we have to provide all the infrastructure that a big city does. And one thing ironic about Mosier is our entire city government is volunteer. And I think something about that keeps it very pure. You know, we're doing this for the love of our community. We're not doing this for the love of our pocketbooks by any means. So it's an exciting thing, and I can't think of anything more worthwhile when the state of the planet is really at stake.
So, Dan, do you have any other closing ideas?
Yeah, I think what Mosier has done has been, by speaking up, it's also emboldened other places and other people. So we see, you know, we're expecting tomorrow on Saturday to hear from people who are coming from Spokane, from Yakima, from Tacoma, from Hermiston, from Vancouver, obviously, and all up and down the gorge.
From Hood River.
From Hood River, of course.
Yeah, and from Mosier.
Yeah, the mayor of Hood River will be there to speak. And so these elected officials, and then even more than that, these tribal leaders who are coming from different nations to speak on behalf of their people, this is a really powerful outpouring, and it should send a message that is unmistakable to Governor Inslee and other people who have the authority and have the power through their role as governor or whatever else to turn these projects down. I think the will of places like Mosier is being reflected in even bigger cities. So that fire that started there continued in a very positive way, I think, through many of these other places. And now we need to seal the deal, and we need to close the door on what would be the largest oil terminal in North America. Five trains a day, just like the one that derailed and burned in Mosier. I don't think it should take too much high level reasoning to realize that that's a very bad idea.
Well, if people want to learn more about this, actually, on Monday, we're premiering my latest radio documentary called Sacrifice Zones. It features Dan and Arlene in very big roles, and we spend about 10 minutes on Mosier and a lot more on the Vancouver Energy Project. So you can tune in. It's at the Locus Focus time, plus 15 minutes. Starts at 10 o'clock Monday morning and runs until 11. And I want to thank Dan and Arlene, for one thing, for how much you contributed to that radio documentary. I really appreciate that, and I'm really glad to talk to you today. So thanks, both of you, for being on.
Thanks, Arlene.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Thanks, everybody. And it takes a village.
And have a good trip back here.
Awesome.
Okay. Well, we've been talking with Columbia River Keepers Conservation Director Dan Sears and Mosier Mayor Arlene Burns, and you've been listening to Locus Focus Friday edition here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next Monday, June 5th, we premiere my new radio documentary, Sacrifice Zones, about efforts to turn the Pacific Northwest into a fossil fuel export hub. My engineer is Sam Parrish. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go with some music by Jim Pepper. Thanks for listening.